Okay. Yeah, the numbers are moving, so that started. Today we're going to start in Deuteronomy chapter 33. Now, it was 3 weeks ago that we started in Deuteronomy chapter 31, and we got to see in there where Moses wrote out the laws, the commands, the blessings, and so on, the warnings of God. And those were to be read every 7 years as the people came together for the Feast of Booths and for the remission of debts. And the idea was all Israel be gathered. That's a time for them to hear. It's a time to involve the children, and it's to bring about fear of the Lord so that they will carefully obey all the law that was written. And the Lord then told Moses that Joshua was now to be commissioned in front of everybody. Moses was in his final days. And he said, Lord went right ahead and said, the people will play the harlot with strange gods, and Yahweh's anger will be kindled. He'll forsake them. And so they will remember, Moses was to teach them a song that they would learn, and God himself said, they will remember it. They will not forget it. And I think that probably was likely God's own work to ensure that would happen. So in front of the assembly, Joshua's commissioned. And the basic message was be strong and courageous. And Moses also commanded the Levites that they were to carry this book of the law along with the Ark of the Covenant. And he made the comment, you've rebelled while I'm alive. How much more after I die will you be a rebellious people? We moved over into chapter 32. And that's where we saw the song. And the song was a proclamation about Yahweh, his gratefulness, his faithfulness, his justice, as well as the corruption of the people, despite Yahweh's leading and rescuing them time and again, and that he had taken them as his people. And when they scorn him, his anger will be kindled, there will be great calamities, and there will be violence, starvation, and God will spur on enemies to come against them, that they would learn from it. But those enemies will be limited and judged. And part of the purpose for that is to keep those enemies from believing it was their strength and power, because God will judge their evil acts and they will know it was Yahweh that gave them those moments of success against Israel. And he says, rejoice, O nations, in verse 43 of chapter 32. God avenges the blood of his servants on his adversaries, and he's going to atone for his land and this people. In all of this, God retains these people as his own. And the purpose of the difficulties and the anger and the calamities is so they'll go to the song, remember, and return to God. And so he's always working to bring them back, even in his moments where his anger burns. And then the Lord again tells Moses, this is the time of the end. You'll go to the mountain. You'll die there. And don't forget, Moses, it's not because you're old. It's because you did not treat me as holy in front of the people at the waters of Meribah. What a lesson for all of us. We're saved. Doesn't mean we can be frivolous with how we live our lives. We need to treat God as holy at every turn. Moses is a good demonstration of that. Which brings us to chapter 33, which is where we're starting today. That was really quick, but the order of the day is to be efficient with the time. So, in chapter 33, we're going to get a blessing that is cited as coming from Moses. Let me first begin with the first five verses. Now, this is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the sons of Israel before his death. He said, the Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. There he shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. At his right hand there were flashing lightning for them. Indeed, he loves the people. All your holy ones are in your hand, and they followed your steps. Everyone receives your words. Moses charged us with the law, a possession for the assembly of Jacob, and he was king in Jeshurun, when the heads of the people were gathered, the tribes of Israel together. And so in these first five verses, one thing we can pick up on right away is just by the way it's written, a basically a third person talking about Moses in that way and in past tense. So we can see that chapters 33 and 34 are not written by Moses himself, but are recorded with regard to what happened, what Moses said, what Moses did, and the events that occurred. And interestingly enough, when we look at it, that always raises a question. Well, if Moses didn't write it, who did? And the honest, quick answer is, we don't know. One of the things that is often put forward is that these words were penned by Joshua. And so that's one of the prevailing thoughts, suppositions that maybe Joshua did it, but honestly, we can't prove that one way or another. But what we do clearly see is that verses 1 through 5 are a praising of God. And it starts in verse 1 with a blessing by the man of God to the sons of Israel. And if we look back at that verse, it said, "This is the blessing with which Moses, the man of God, blessed the sons of Israel before his death." And of course, he's going to be holding God up high. But that man of God, that's the first time those particular words are used to describe somebody in Scripture. First time, and it's used 70 more times in the Old Testament, and then a number of times in the New Testament. And honestly, it doesn't mean that we can go to that then and define this as a title and say every time you see it, it means the same thing. Context is needed. But you can say that when you look at its place, it is a time in which men are speaking on behalf of God or being called to speak on behalf of God. And so the context is very revealing. The next occurrence, for example, is over in 1 Samuel 2. We're not going to turn there. I'm going to tell you about it. But 1 Samuel chapter 2, verse 27, and the man of God says to Eli, it's an angel, it's a messenger of God. When you read that one before you get done, you know, God is given credit for the words there in many cases. But it's when God is bringing judgment on Eli's family, on his sons. He had evil sons that were sinning grossly as part of the Levitical responsibilities they had as priests. And the message is, we're going to raise up a faithful priest. And of course, we know who's coming, that's Samuel. And then also in 1 Samuel chapter 9 then, it is used to signify Samuel as the one that's going to be speaking for God. He's described as a man of God. He's a prophet. He's given God's word to bring to the people. The first New Testament use is 1 Timothy 6:11. This is where Paul is saying to Timothy, he's describing things. And let's turn over to that one because it's linked with a verse that we're used to. 2 Timothy chapter 3. I said 1 Timothy. Okay, let me back up. 1 Timothy 6 is the next time, and it's just a command. You flee from these things, you man of God, and he's talking to Timothy. Where I want to go to look up is 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17. 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17. It is still Paul talking to Timothy, giving him instructions about living. And I can't make my fingers turn to Timothy today. Oh, that's why. Trying to put it in the wrong place. Okay. I've gone by it both ways a couple times. 2 Timothy 3, 16 and 17. Almost don't even need to turn to it. Many of you, like me, have it memorized or near memorized. We use 2 Timothy 3, 16 all the time in holding up the scriptures and their role in our lives. All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness. But verse 17 starts with that phrase, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. And so here's Paul talking to Timothy about the role of scriptures in the life of Timothy, but also then in the life of us as the scriptures are brought to us. So the man of God may be adequate if we think about the man of God being one to bring the words of God. We need to know the scripture in order to do that and to be equipped for the good work that we're to do. So, the man of God, Timothy, is the man of God. Often in some of what Paul said there, he's the preacher and he's even the believer, you and I, using the scriptures. Back if we look at Deuteronomy 33, the use here, of course, is Moses. And Moses was a great prophet. We can't overstate Moses' role as a prophet very easily. And we'll get to talking about that as we go through this morning a little bit. In verse 2, he pronounces blessing on Israel, and he does it by taking them back through their history. The Lord came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir and shone forth from Mount Paran. And he came from the midst of the 10,000 holy ones. At his right hand there was flashing lightning for them. Well, it's kind of hard to put all of the specifics with this and be very exacting about it. Mount Sinai, we can even say there's not 100% agreement on where's Mount Sinai. I would guess that most of you that went through the class of Exodus, we pretty much determined that Mount Sinai is east of the Gulf of Aqaba and saw a lot of evidence of why that would be. And that's where it is. But when you look at Mount Sinai, there are other locations that traditionally have been included as potential sites. But when we look at Seir and Paran, so what's the point? Well, the point here is that this traces back through some of their history in getting to the point where they are now. Started from Mount Sinai. How did it start in Mount Sinai? What was the beginning role of Mount Sinai in the Exodus? Angel of the Lord appeared to Moses in the burning bush and sent him to Egypt to lead his people back. Where did God tell him at that time he was going to take the people? What was going to be one of the stops? You remember? Mount Sinai. And so Mount Sinai played a key role. Sometimes it's called the Mountain of God and some other names in the Old Testament that fit right in. So God takes them back to Mount Sinai. What kind of an experience was that for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai?
Terrifying.
God, we don't want to hear from, or Moses, we don't want to hear from God anymore. He's too loud. He's scary. You talk to him, you get the information for us, and we'll do what you tell us he said to do. Yeah, right. They didn't do very well with that, but that's the path they picked. And in here he talked about in his right hand there was flashing lightning for them. I mean, God made his presence majestically known and seen on Mount Sinai. He descended with a cloud, thunder, lightning. It was a terrifying moment. Even a fence built, what would happen if you crossed the fence? Markers would be a better word. What's that?
You die.
Not only you, but if your critter crossed the markers, your critter was going to die. God showed his magnificence and holiness in a great way. So people of Israel, Moses is saying, remember that. And then also he brings in Mount Seir. And in Deuteronomy chapter 2, it said that they circled Mount Seir many days. It was the Lord's direction, and it was at Mount Seir that he said, okay, let's go north, let's go to Mount Paran. We believe that that is likely somewhere up there near the plain of Moab, one of the mountains there. It's on the way, at least, to there. It's probably in the wilderness of Paran, the Negev area, south of Israel. God tells them, you're not going to do battle with Esau's descendants, because I've given Esau the area of Mount Paran, or the wilderness of Paran. It's mentioned in the book of Habakkuk, Seir is, and God is called the Holy One from Mount Paran. I'm sorry, I skipped to Mount Paran. My notes say Seir there, but I'm down talking about Paran at this point. So Habakkuk also brings Mount Paran in, but these three mountains were a big part of their journey, and that's part of their 40 years. It's coming to an end when they begin their trek to the wilderness of Paran. And in verse 3, he goes on to say, indeed, he loves the people. All the holy ones are in your hand, and they followed in your steps. Everyone receives your words. Moses charged us with the law, verse 4. It's a possession for the assembly of Jacob. And so I'm going to stop there for a minute. The people then are being told, the writer is saying, reminding them, that Moses talked about how he loved the people. And then the writer at some point is saying, and maybe it's Moses, everyone receives your words. They're a possession. They're a resource. They're a tool. It are the words of God that can take them through their life in possessing the land and their life as people who live in the land. And Moses is reminding of that. Verse 5 gets a little bit interesting. Because in verse 5, he talks about being king in Jeshurun, which Jeshurun is righteous prosperity. And these people were rarely righteous, and they were wanderers, and yet they knew prosperity. As a matter of fact, as they prepare to go into the promised land, as they are there with Moses, and Moses is leading them, they have some great successes militarily, don't they? What's their primary success while they're there on the plain of Moab that shows them some of the prosperity to come as they are making conquest of the land of Canaan? What happened? Remember?
One of their men were killed.
Well, none of their men were killed as they went down and did war against Midian. There's another pretty significant thing that happens as they arrive on the plain of Moab. What about the land to the north of them? They're on the plain of Moab, and they're in the land of the Amorites, right? And they very easily just take all that land militarily, and God makes it clear, I did this. Don't think you did it. I did it. But already we've got 2.5 tribes who are generally more devoted to shepherding than other things, and they're moving into this land, which was great for grazing their flocks. There are already places built for their sheltering their shocks, their livestock, and doing all of those things. And so they've enjoyed great prosperity here as they're preparing to go into the promised land. So it's a time of prosperity there on the plains of Moab. And you've got 2.5 tribes that are settled, and Moses really was in charge, was he not? So functionally, he acted as a king. This is a royal word, which is a little unusual, but he's there as Yahweh's representative, as a prophet, and he represents them, and he communicates God to them, and by action, he often was on his face before the Lord pleading for the people. His heart and his life was aligned with getting these people to the promised land in the way that God wanted it done. And it talks about the heads of the people being gathered. And when we talk about that, this is a time, remember, they got together there on the plains of Moab, and they got all the people together, and all the leaders of the tribes were there, and they talked about the things in the recent weeks that we were just through about what was done with regard to the law and how they were to follow it, and they renewed their law covenant, so they had everybody together at once to do that. I skipped over something, and I think I probably need to go back and think about it. In verse 2, it says this, he came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. And John MacArthur goes down a path with this in looking at his explanation of these verses. that he believes it were likely came from the angels God did that were assisting Yahweh in the actions, but also in giving the law. And when I first read what John MacArthur said, I went, what? How do you get there? But there's an interesting place to go to see that. Go over to Acts chapter 7. And is that really what Moses was thinking of? I can't promise you that I know that it was. But whether it was or whether it wasn't, this is surely an interesting thing to look at. Acts chapter 7, we're in the middle. We're going to be looking at verse 53. We're in the middle of Stephen's speech as one of the deacons, the man selected to serve the women, the widows of the Hellenistic Jews. And he was cornered by the Jews and the Jewish leaders. And he wound up giving a speech that really proclaimed God, proclaimed the truth, proclaimed all of these things. But it cost him, I don't know that it cost him his life. It was God's first martyr, not first. It was one of God's martyrs with regard to the believers that were now following Christ, despite him already being crucified. So chapter 7, verse 53, it says this. He's talking to these people who are Jews that are full of hatred for him. And he says, you who received the law as ordained by angels and yet did not keep it. Angels can be messengers, but also certainly we know that there are beings that are part of the heavenly world that are angels. Satan used to be an angel, but he rebelled and took many other angels with him. About a third of the angels in heaven followed Satan. But Stephen here cites angels as one as a group that were part of ordaining or receive or sending out the law. Galatians 3 is also interesting. Galatians 3, 18 and 19. Yes. Galatians 3, 18 and 19 says this. For if the inheritance is based on law, it is no longer based on promise. But God has granted it to Abraham by means of a promise. Why is it law then? It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator until the seed would come to whom the promise had been made. In other words, looking forward to Christ, the law was given intermediately, and it was ordained through angels. Similar words again. We don't see those in the Old Testament much, but here it says, by the agency of a mediator. And there's a couple of mediators with regard to the law, but the primary one is Moses. He's the one that voiced the law on God's behalf. Hebrews 2:2, another good one. I can't just skip over it. Hebrews 2:2. We're talking about the law again. For if the word spoken through angels proved unalterable and every transgression and every obedience received a just penalty, that was verse 2, then verse 3, how will we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? After it was first spoken through the Lord, it was confirmed to us by those who heard. Word spoken through angels proved unalterable, the law of God. So in the New Testament, we get a lot more information about the role of angels in the giving of the law. Questions, comments over those first five verses? So we see that they're involved, but don't get too many specifics about what their role was, other than they were there serving on God's behalf and ordaining it to get it to us and to Moses and the Jews in particular. Any other comments? Anything? Then let's look at verses 6 through 11. And this is the first, I'm going to break it up into several sections. But Moses talks about each of the tribes. I say each when we get all done, which may not be this week. We'll bring up kind of an exception there. But this is what Moses starts doing as far as blessings and his thoughts about the tribes. May Reuben live and not die, nor his men be few. And this regarding Judah, so he said, hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him to his people. With his hands he contended for them. And may you be a help against his adversaries. Of Levi he said, let your Thummim and your Urim belong to your godly man, whom you proved at Massa, with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah. Who said of his father and his mother, I did not consider them, and he did not acknowledge his brothers, nor did he regard his own sons, for they observed your word and kept your covenant. They shall teach your ordinances to Jacob and your law to Israel. And they shall put incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar. O Lord, bless his substance and accept the work of his hand. Shatter the loins of those who rise up against him and those who hate him, so they will not rise again. So he starts off with Reuben, and he does start with the oldest firstborn among Jacob's sons. However, it seems fairly random after that. But it's a very short comment for Reuben. It says that he may live and that he may be more than a few men. Normally, Reuben would be the leader, being the oldest of the group. But that's not the case here. Moses is just saying, well, I hope he survives. I pray for his survival and that they won't be just a small tribe, but they will be more than a few. And then he goes to Judah, the fourthborn. But Judah has become the leader. But he says about him, hear his voice. Let him be an influence. He rose to prominence after his sin and his acknowledgement of it. And he began to show leadership when Judah as a son was still alive. And so may this tribe continue in prominence. Reuben, the firstborn, and Simeon, the secondborn, had sinned. They had a violent revenge in Shechem. And in addition, Simeon was sleeping with Bilhah, one of the handmaiden that had come to Jacob and was actually mother of some of these other brothers. And Jacob is thoroughly frustrated with these two men, particularly it comes out after their vicious attack on Shechem. And they were getting revenge for how their sister had been treated in the town of Shechem. She'd been taken advantage of. I'm saying it nicely. She was raped. And was in. They were going to take her into the family of Shechem, the leading family of Shechem, and these two boys worked up a plan and wound up putting to death the men of Shechem. And Jacob was upset. What are you doing? You've made us an unspeakable people here, and we've got to move. And so they've got to pick up and move. And Jacob is very upset. And after that, Judah was with his daughter-in-law, Tamar. It was a widow of one of his sons, and he had hired her for purposes of prostitution and didn't know it was her, but he was going to have her put to death when she started revealing things. But when it came out that it was him that she had been sleeping with, or had slept with at least this once, slept with is a nice euphemism. He spoke up and said, no, she's not guilty, I am. And from that point on, he became more of a leader. And we see other things that are going to happen with regard to the tribe of Judah over time. Jesus is going to be in the tribe of Judah. And also, of course, because Jesus is in the household of David, he's going to be the eternal king in the line of David. David is also in the line of Judah. And so out of that time of leadership Judah emerges as somewhat of a leader among his brothers. And so Moses calls on God to hear the tribe of Judah, to protect them, and to be a help when they have adversaries come up against them. And then he goes to Levi, which is the thirdborn, and he mentions the Thummim and the Urim. And why does he bring up the Thummim and the Urim? Let them belong to your godly man whom you proved at Massah, whom you contended at the waters of Meribah. Why does he bring that up? What's the Urim and the Thummim got to do with all of this? It's part of their priestly garb. It's also a part of the decision-making and how they receive information from God. We might say it's kind of chance, but it isn't. It's God using them to pass along information. They are separate from the other tribes, right? And one of the things that is said here is that they did not, nor did he regard his own sons. And what is that talking about? I don't know that I can say exactly what Moses was thinking about, but one of the things that happened was two of Aaron's sons misbehaved. You remember? What did they do?
Brought strange fire.
They simply did not follow the instructions given on how to burn the incense in the tabernacle. And God would have none of it. So what did God do? He killed them. How did he kill them?
He consumed them
with fire. And it was a difficult moment for Aaron. You can imagine what's going on. But Aaron was called to not mourn them, but accept this punishment. And he did. He didn't regard his own sons outside of their misbehavior. And he says, they're the keepers of the word. They keep your covenants. Their role is to teach Israel. Their role is to burn the incense. They're to lead in the worship. They're to make whole burnt sacrifices, burnt offering on Yahweh's own altar. So Moses is praying that Yahweh will accept their products, their offerings, and the works that they do, and prays that Yahweh himself will shatter the loins of adversaries that might come up against them, and do so in such a way they can never come up and rise up against them again. So Moses is looking at the role of the Levites that will come down through the ages and is asking Yahweh to let them be successful in that in his eyes and endure in those roles. Questions, comments on those verses? All right, well, let's take a look at a few more verses, and this probably will be as far as we get today. Let's look at verses 12 through 17. A Benjamin, he, Moses, said, may the beloved of the Lord dwell in security by him who shields him all the day and dwells between his shoulders. Of Joseph, he said, blessed of the Lord be his land, with the choice things of heaven, with the dew and from the deep lying beneath, and with the choice yield of the sun and the choice produce of the months, and with the best things of the ancient mountains, and with the choice things of the everlasting hills, and with the choice things of the earth in its fullness, and the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. Let it come to the head of Joseph, and to the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. As the firstborn of his ox, majesty is his. As his horns are the horns of the wild ox. With them he will push the peoples all at once to the ends of the earth, and those who are 10,000 of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. So he starts with Benjamin, which is the 12th born, and he talks about Benjamin dwelling by Yahweh in security as one that is beloved, be shielded all day long, dwells between his shoulders. So he's talking about Benjamin in a way that is, you know, let him be special to you. Let him be held by you. Let him have security as one that you love and care for and shield him. And he dwells between his shoulders. It's a safe spot. Benjamin is going to be a tribe up on the very northern part of the land after they've taken it. And so he's going to be in a defensive position if people want to attack from the north. And Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin, is going to have its bad days. They are ones that are going to get involved in some pretty ugly sin and so on. But at this point, Moses is asking for God to give them a place of security and a place that would be protected. Joseph, now when we talk about Joseph, we really wind up talking about two groups, and we'll get to Ephraim and Manasseh before we're done. But he says, let Joseph be blessed of the Lord. Let him have choice things from heaven, the dew, the sustenance, and from the deep, from the waters and the hills and the sun and the earth. Moses is calling for him, let him prosper in the land. Let him have great success in his material prosperity and find favor of what's going on here. And I got a note here that I need to understand a little better. And the favor of him who dwelt in the bush. What are we talking about here? Who is that? Whose favor is Moses wishing to fall upon Joseph's clan?
Is that a callback to the burning bush?
That's my opinion. That's what I really believe is. Him who dwells in the bush, when Moses came upon that burning bush, here it was burning, it was not being consumed by fire. It's clear that God was there in the burning bush. And so let him find favor from the one who was seen in the burning bush. And that he would be the distinguished among the brothers and deserve the crown. Joseph indeed became the leader. When did Joseph become the leader of the brothers? In Egypt. God, in reality, before the beginning of time, God determined it, right? Okay, we could play those things out and see that would be true. But in terms of physical events on earth, when Joseph became the leader of all Egypt before the tribes willingly came under him, and they came under him when they moved to Egypt and had their time of prosperity there with Joseph being number two to Pharaoh. And he was number two of Pharaoh as a very just and righteous man. I mean, he didn't come by that in some devious way. He came by that because God blessed him to be able to tell what the dreams meant to Pharaoh, but also gave him the ability to manage all of that for their advantage of the people of Egypt, that they would not starve. In verse 17, he says, to be a pusher of the peoples. He talks about the horns and pushing with the horns. And Moses is talking about them having a military success. He talks about the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. Why would Ephraim be, those are the two sons of Joseph, right? Why would Ephraim be the larger? Taking you back through some of our history, and that goes clear back to the end of the book of Genesis. Yeah, Jacob's there and he has his hands on him the way that Jacob's going to do it, but he's got him crossed because Joseph had brought the brothers in, so the one that was on Jacob's right, which is the hand of the great blessing, would be on the elder, which was Manasseh. And Jacob crossed his arms and Joseph said, no. And Jacob said, yes, this is how it's going to be, that Manasseh will be great, but Ephraim will be much greater. And indeed, that is what we see. In the conquest, Ephraim is a great part of their fighting strength, and he is very successful in his roles in the fighting and the taking of conquest. So that's probably what Moses is talking about. Did that very quickly and at a pretty high level. I don't know that I have a lot of other details I would be able to add. What questions, comments might you have this morning?
Hebrews Author, he's making comparison between Mount Sinai and Mount Zion in heaven in Jerusalem. And there's also going to be an innumerable company of angels at Mount Zion, as there was at Mount Sinai.
Yep. The angels, we're not done with them in terms of their roles. Yep. You know, when David talks about angels, I just can't help it. Every time I hear angels, I think about, well, don't you know you will be judging the angels? I'm not sure I want in on that. I mean, I do because God says I will, or God says some of us will, or something. I just, you know, that would be very intimidating to me when I think of angels and then being a part of judging them in some fashion. I'm really not too concerned about judging anybody else in heaven. My focus at that time is going to be, oh, I'm really here. Beyond that, I just can't imagine, but I know it's going to be different than the way I think about it now, so I'll trust God to lead me into those moments. That's amazing. Thank you, David. Yep, Mount Zion. Jerusalem is kind of mentioned. Well, not mentioned, but it's one thing we could look at in here when we get a little further down the road in terms of one of the tribes. Anything else?
I think it's interesting to note in Psalm 90, the title of that psalm is a prayer of Moses to the hand of God.
I didn't pick that up.
Yeah. So that's the subscript title for Psalm 90. A prayer of Moses to the hand of God.
I'll have to go look at that.
From Asa's perspective, 500 years later, really gives a really good detailed commentary on the entire Exodus, Psalm 78. So be worth, if you're interested, be worth reading.
Yep.
Could you repeat those two Psalms?
I certainly will. Psalm 90 is about Moses, the man of God, by title. And Psalm 78 is a synopsis of the Exodus. Well, we've done a pretty high flyby on this morning. Next time we'll pick it up with Deuteronomy 33, verse 18, and see how far we can get. Thank you. Have a good morning.